This morning's program is about to begin. I'd like to present Department Assistant and Graduate Student Matt Harrison, who will introduce our first speaker.
Good morning. Professor McKenzie is an assistant professor in the Department of Historical Theology. Before joining the faculty in 1983, he served St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Detroit, Michigan as pastor and as headmaster of the school. Professor McKenzie received his AB from the University of Detroit, an MA in history from the University of Chicago, an MA in classics from Wayne State University, and an STM in New Testament from Concordia, Fort Wayne. He's currently working on his doctorate from the University of Notre Dame. He has a remarkable ability to impart verities in a most objective fashion without the slightest acrimony. For it was from him that many of us first learned that seminex is indeed a Latin word which means half dead. Every year in his course on the Lutheran Church in America, he uses his unique, even extraordinary talents to fool many students into believing that there is truly some existential significance or relevance in knowing the date of every Lutheran merger that took place in the last 300 years in America. He has been called an expert on the Puritan movement, and this is something anyone who knows him will certainly verify, for he not only knows it, he lives it. Without any further ado, Professor Cameron McKenzie.
Thanks very much, Matt. I know some of you who looked at your schedule were expecting somebody from Norway to speak to you this morning on different contemporary Lutheran views regarding the ministry. Our professor Alstead couldn't make it, so you got me instead. For those of you who are disappointed, I'll try to respond to question and answer with a Norwegian accent. When asked to do this substitution just a little more than 24 hours ago, I was pleased to be asked. I didn't say a word about honorarium, but I would like Matt to take this word back to Dr. Scare that I do expect to get Professor Austad's mileage. That's probably about the last laugh we'll have this morning, as we now turn our attention to a paper that I've entitled Anglicans, Puritans, Church, and Ministry. The term Puritan is one of those wonderful words that first appears in church history as a term of abuse, an insult hurled at those whom the hurler would just as soon see reduced to objects of mockery and scorn as have to deal honestly with their criticisms and concerns. Even today, the term Puritan carries with it certain negative connotations of hypocritical prudishness, so that it's still insulting to be labeled a Puritan. From American history, however, we probably all have learned to recognize the term also as one that designates a specific group of 17th century Englishmen who were largely responsible for the original establishment of the New England colonies like Massachusetts Bay and Connecticut, and for the creation of major American cultural institutions like Harvard University or the town hall meeting. What we don't often learn, or perhaps don't remember, is that the American Puritans were just a part of a larger English Puritan movement, many of whose participants did not come to America at all. In fact, following the establishment of New England, those Puritans who stayed at home fought a civil war, beheaded a king, and established a Christian commonwealth in England that replaced the monarchy for more than a decade before being replaced itself by the monarchy once again. Furthermore, we don't always remember that this kind of Puritanism first manifested itself not in the 17th, but in the 16th century, the late Reformation period of Elizabeth I. Indeed, the same period of time that saw continental Lutheranism being torn apart by those controversies that resulted in the Formula of Concord saw the Church of England experiencing similar tensions and strains that ultimately the established church could not accommodate, with the result that instead of one English-speaking Protestant denomination, there arose several, to wit, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, and Baptists, among others. The purpose, then, of this paper is to provide an introduction to Puritan origins, especially from the standpoint of the ministry that was a continuing focus of Puritan demands upon the English establishment. The relevance of this topic to our symposium in general, I suppose, is twofold. First, an opportunity for comparison with the Lutheran understanding of the ministry that was being formulated in roughly the same time period, under similar circumstances, but with different theological and confessional foundations. And secondly, an occasion for better appreciation of America's religious history. For as much as we are determined to remain faithful to our Lutheran heritage, all of us must express that faithfulness in an American context, the origins of which are rooted in Puritanism. At one time or another, the term Puritan has been used to describe virtually all non-Anglican Protestant Christians of England. But originally, in the 16th century, it was used not against those who left the Church of England, but against those who stayed within and sought to change the shape of that church. Hence, the rather standard dichotomy, Anglican and Puritan, is somewhat misleading if it suggests two contrary parties, since Puritans were Anglicans, if by the latter we mean simply those who belonged to the Church of England. The concern of the former, then, was not to repudiate the Church of England, but to improve it, to build on the theological foundations laid by Thomas Cranmer and others, according to the models of Reformation that the continental churches of Geneva, Zurich, and elsewhere supplied. One important focus of Puritan criticism was the Church's Book of Common Prayer of 1559, and especially certain ceremonial elements that were mandated by the Church's liturgy. And the first public revelation of a Puritan critique of the established Church was the so-called Vestiarian controversy of the mid-1560s. In particular, when Convocation met in 1563, and Convocation was the official synod of bishops and representatives of the lower clergy that always met in conjunction with Parliament, the lower house of Convocation entertained a proposal for reform of church ceremonies, such as taking away organs from sanctuaries, removing saints' days from the calendar, and abolishing the sign of the cross in baptism and kneeling to receive communion. In addition, there were at least two demands directly related to their understanding of the ministry: the elimination of the clerical vestments that characterized the medieval ministry, and requiring the minister always to face the congregation instead of the east end of the church. On the one hand, eliminating medieval vestments indicated a repudiation of any sacerdotal conception of the ministry. For Puritans, the one offering of Christ upon the cross was sufficient for all time, so that there was no place within the New Testament church for any sacrificing and mediating priesthood. Just as the sacrifice of the Mass had to go, so a sacerdotal priesthood could find no place in a correctly reformed Church of England. And therefore, that dress, which to the eye suggested the unreformed priesthood, should also be eliminated. On the other hand, the Puritan insistence that ministers face their congregation was evidence of a new and positive conception of the ministry that saw those who held the position as the representatives of God to the people, placed into a divinely mandated office for the proclamation of God's word and the administration of God's sacraments to God's church. Now, if that sounds suspiciously like our own Lutheran understanding of the ministry, don't be surprised. It should. For it is my contention that what distinguishes Lutheran from Reformed, and in this case particularly Puritan, conceptions of the ministry, is not so much the nature of the office as the nature of the means of grace that holders of the office minister, that is, word and sacraments. Furthermore, in articulating this understanding of the ministry, Puritans were at one with the Anglican establishment, which at the same convocation of 1563 approved a doctrinal statement, the 39 Articles, that became the law of the land in 1571. In this creed of Anglicanism, Article 31 clearly rejects any sacrifice of the Mass since, quote, "The offering of Christ once made is the perfect redemption, propitiation, and satisfaction for all the sins of the whole world." And Article 23 affirms a new understanding of the ministry as, I quote again, "the office of public preaching or ministering the sacraments in the congregation," unquote. So, at this point in 1563, the argument of the Puritans with their own Church of England was not about the ministry, but about how ministers should dress and act in carrying out their task of public proclamation of the word. Indeed, since both sides agreed that ceremonies generally fell into the category of adiaphora or things indifferent, their initial dispute was really about the extent to which such adiaphora became non-adiaphora on account of theological associations, and who in the church has authority to make a binding decision regarding such matters. With respect to that last point, authority in the church, the 39 Articles are perhaps ambiguous, perhaps not, but at any rate, on the one hand, they very clearly enunciate a sola scriptura doctrinal position in Article 6. Holy Scripture containeth all things necessary to salvation, so that whatsoever is not read therein, nor may be proved thereby, is not to be required of any man, that it should be believed as an article of the faith, or be thought requisite necessary to salvation. But on the other hand, there is also the practical matter of who in the institutional church has the final say about matters ecclesiastical. And here, in spite of retaining the historic episcopate, the English church answers that the monarch has the last word. In Article 38, they write, "The Queen's Majesty hath the chief power in this realm of England and other her dominions, unto whom the chief government of all estates of the realm, whether they be ecclesiastical or civil, in all causes doth appertain and is not nor ought to be subject to any foreign jurisdiction." The article goes on to insist that the Queen's authority is not that of the clergy to proclaim the word, nor is her authority in any respect over the word, but rather that her authority is that which, quote, "we see to have been given always to all godly princes in Holy Scriptures by God himself," unquote. Interestingly enough, Elizabethan Puritans never challenged the authority of the Queen over the church. Perhaps because the Queen, though clearly hostile to Puritan demands upon her church, used the hierarchy to check and control its critics. In the Vestiarian controversy, for example, it was Archbishop Matthew Parker and his fellow bishops whom Elizabeth required to impose ceremonial conformity upon the church. Using their episcopal authority and not her royal authority, at least not directly, Parker and company demanded conformity from the clergy, or else they risked the loss of their positions. And after some defiance and much posturing, in 1565 and 1566, the bishops obtained their way, at least for the moment. Through succeeding decades, as critics of the Church of England, either raise the ceremonial issues again or else turn their attention to long-standing abuses such as pluralism and non-residency of the clergy that made a preaching ministry an elusive ideal in England instead of a reality in the 16th century. The bishops often seem to be the major stumbling blocks in the way of reform. Consequently, this led some of the Puritans to reassess the place of bishops in the Church of England and to conclude on the basis of the scriptures that a Presbyterian system of church government was necessary in a thoroughly reformed church instead of an Episcopal system. This kind of Puritanism first arose in the 1570s and became a very serious threat to the establishment in the 1580s. Although checked at that time as a practical alternative to the Episcopal system, the Presbyterian ideal remained so appealing that during the English Civil War in the 1640s, there was a serious attempt to remake the Church of England into a Presbyterian system by the parliamentary opponents of the king. Paradoxically, however, the Presbyterian assault during Elizabeth's reign also provoked a new appreciation by some for bishops, so that the next part of this paper will attempt to show that the basic unity at the outset of the reign between Puritans and the establishment regarding the nature of the ministry was shattered by the development of two quite different theologies of church government. The greatest proponent of Presbyterianism in Elizabethan England was Thomas Cartwright. One time, he was the Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity at Cambridge. And in 1570, while lecturing upon the Book of Acts at that university, he began to argue that the New Testament required a system of church government far different from that which existed at present in England. After rebuke by responsible university and ecclesiastical authorities, Cartwright preferred to lose his position and retire for a time to the continent rather than change his theological mind. But shortly thereafter, the Presbyterian challenge entered a more serious phase when in 1571, a bill was introduced into Parliament that required a change in church government, and proponents, including Cartwright, began a publicity campaign in support of this bill. In this literary warfare of the 1570s over church government, the principal defender of the establishment was John Whitgift, who in 1583 would become Archbishop of Canterbury. Regarding the ministry, the principal matter between Cartwright and Whitgift was the question of order, that is, authority in the church to regulate entrance into the ministry and to supervise the clergy. It was not a question regarding the nature of the ministry as a preaching office of the church. As one might expect from one whom we are calling Presbyterian, Cartwright argued that the New Testament required a system of church government in which authority was vested in committees consisting of pastors and lay elders. Such a committee, often called a consistory or seniory, would be found, first of all, in the local congregation and would have responsibility for ceremonies, charitable enterprises, and, of course, discipline. It would also be responsible for sending clerical and lay representatives to a provincial assembly and even a national synod, where the ultimate ecclesiastical authority would lie. In other words, a Presbyterian system would still be hierarchical, but instead of a hierarchy of persons, it would establish a hierarchy of consistories or presbyteries. Cartwright was insistent that there be an equality of clergy, as signified by his recommendations regarding ordination. In the Church of England of the 1570s, Ordination was no longer medieval in form, but it did remain a monopoly of the bishops, so that they controlled entrance into the office of the ministry. The ordinal of the Church of England had been reformed even during the Edwardian Reformation before the days of Elizabeth, and it no longer provided for the bishop to impart to the one being ordained a paten and a chalice, nor did it authorize commissioning him with the words, "Receive the power to offer sacrifice to God." All of that was gone. But the ordinal did provide for the bishop alone to transmit a Bible and to make this more Protestant commission of the clergy, quote, "Take thou authority to preach the word of God and to minister the holy sacraments in this congregation." Commission and Bible, for that matter, were both acceptable to Cartwright, but not the authority of the bishop over the proceedings. Instead, Cartwright argued for the following. A vacant parish should have recourse to its provincial council for a pastor. When one is so provided, there should be a trial period for the new pastor within his new congregation, after which the provincial council would authorize the ordination of the man by one of its own clergy members, who then, along with the elders of the calling congregation, would lay hands on the new minister to signify to him that he is lawfully called to that parish to be pastor there. Now, the difference between this system and the one in Elizabeth's church is that a presbytery replaces the bishop. However, a Presbyterian minister still does what an Anglican one does, and that is preach the word and administer the sacraments. Arguing the other side of the question, Whitgift, unlike Cartwright, does take positions that I think are surprising to us today, especially if we are enamored of the high church Anglicanism that really arose first in the 19th century Oxford movement. Because here, the future Archbishop of Canterbury does not contend for the divine origin of the English episcopate, but rather argues from the authority of the monarch to establish any kind of government in the church that he sees fit. Whitgift agrees with his adversary that the true church is invisible. He calls it a communion and society of the faithful and elect only. He also agrees with Cartwright that its spiritual head is Christ, who governs his church by his word. Also, like his Presbyterian foe, Whitgift considers the word and the sacraments the essential marks of the church, since they are the instruments by which God gathers the elect into his church. But where Whitgift and his foe part company is on the question of whether the Bible indicates the form of church government that must regulate the external affairs of the church. Cartwright says yes, and Whitgift no. The surprising thing about this early debate, therefore, is the failure of Whitgift to offer any principled defense of the episcopacy. For him, church government is actually an adiaphoron like the church ceremonies. And just as in the Vestiarian controversy, so now in the Presbyterian one, the question for the defenders of the establishment really becomes the authority of the monarch to regulate ecclesiastical matters that are unspecified in the Bible. On the one hand, Scripture points to the necessity of some church government for the regulation of ceremonies, the exercise of discipline, and the supervision of the ministry. But, Whitgift points out, quote, "The offices in the church whereby this government is wrought be not namely and particularly expressed in the Scriptures, but in some points left to the discretion and liberty of the church to be disposed according to the state of times, places, and persons." Unquote. On the one hand, Christ then has established the office of the ministry for preaching and the sacraments, but he has not established a church government for regulating the external affairs of the church. On the other hand, Christ has established civil government to regulate temporal matters generally. When the state is hostile to the church, of course, it has no place in church government. But as in Elizabethan England, when the state is Christian, the monarch is Christian, then the government has the obligation to concern itself with the external arrangements of the church. Whitgift says, "Christ only and properly is the head of the church, for it is his body. But yet, in respect of the external society of the same, and the supreme authority that is given of God to the prince over his people in all causes, he may be also in that respect called the head of the church." The point then regarding the episcopacy is that it is the monarch's choice. For Whitgift, other reformed churches may properly have other forms of church government so long as they have the consent of the civil magistrate. But in England, the God-ordained head of state prefers bishops. So that's that. Now, Whitgift can muster other arguments in favor of the episcopacy as if to justify the monarch's choice. Although he admits to a kind of popular election of clergy in the early church, he also insists that this order of bishops and archbishops is most ancient in the church. It is confirmed by the best and noblest councils. It is followed by the best learned fathers. It hath the pattern from the practice of the apostles. However, Whitgift does not admit to any doctrine of apostolic succession. In fact, really his most persuasive argument in favor of the monarch's choice is not really theological so much as it is political. The Presbyterian system has the potential, Whitgift argues, for undermining a hierarchical state by subjecting the prince to the decisions of consistories and synods regarding external matters of ceremony and discipline. As Whitgift puts it, under Cartwright's system, the queen must execute whatsoever it pleaseth master pastors and the seniors or elders to command her. Else will they stir up the whole country against her. At the very least, she must be excommunicated. Well, this admittedly modest defense of the episcopacy was really the best that the bishops could muster for practically the first three decades of Elizabeth's reign. Not until Whitgift's personal ascendancy in governmental circles and the passing from the scene of some major lay patrons of Puritan clerics such as the Earl of Leicester and Sir Francis Walsingham, Elizabeth's principal secretary, did at length defenders of the establishment seek to develop other lines of defense. According to Peter Lake, and here I am dependent upon the analysis he develops in his 1988 work, Anglicans and Puritans, the late 1580s and 1590s saw the establishment shift its emphasis from the monarch's authority to the divine origin of the episcopacy. Now, this was the position taken by the Bishop of London, Richard Bancroft, who would also succeed Whitgift at Canterbury in 1604. He took this position almost in passing in a sermon that he first preached in February 1589. Bancroft said, "There is no man living, as I suppose, able to show where there was any church planted ever since the apostles' time. But there, the bishops had authority over the rest of the ministry." And again, "The Church of God, ever since the apostles' time, hath distributed the ecclesiastical ministry principally into these three parts: bishops, priests, and deacons." Now, subsequent works by Hadrian Saravia, Matthew Sutcliffe, and Thomas Bilson in this period develop further this line of argument. For these theologians, the scriptures, early church history, and the fathers all justified an episcopal form of church government. Perhaps for us, the argument from the scriptures is the most interesting one. Relying upon hierarchical arrangements in the Old Testament, and especially the supervisory authority of the apostles in the New, these early Episcopalians argued that bishops were of divine origin. For them, all of the clergy remained successors of the apostles in that they carried on their ministry of word and sacrament. But just as Timothy and Titus exercised a kind of special governance and rule in the church, in addition to their ministry of the word, so bishops alone, in every generation, succeeded the apostles as governors of the church. Because then of the controversy with Presbyterian Puritans, early Anglicans developed a doctrine of the ministry that added to a generally Protestant conception of ministry as one of word and sacrament, an additional element, one of order, as found in the historic episcopate. Ironically, then, one of the stumbling blocks in Episcopalian-Lutheran relationships today, that is, the place of the episcopacy, was not really an essential part of the Anglican ministry at all in the eyes of its defenders until many years after the Elizabethan settlement had first been established. Now, as far as the Puritans were concerned, their failure to effect a more thoroughgoing Reformation in England led some of them into taking a much more radical position than the Presbyterians by separating themselves entirely from the Church of England and actually fleeing the country when persecuted by the state. In Elizabethan England, Robert Brown, a Cambridge graduate, was the most prominent of these early separatists and took a community of his followers over to the Netherlands as early as the 1580s. Out of a similar group, there arose, of course, in 1620, the Mayflower Expedition and the establishment of Plymouth Colony in the New World. The real impetus to American colonization by the Puritans, however, did not occur until the 1630s, on account of both the political and religious policies of King Charles I. Politically, Charles seemed determined to rule without calling, without the approval of Parliament, the lower house of which had long been a vehicle for Puritan agitation. And theologically, the king was giving free rein in the 1630s to an Arminian wing of the English church. Now, the significance of Arminianism for the doctrine of the ministry in Anglicanism is really too complicated for us to explore here. But we can make the point that the Arminian ascendancy of the 1630s drove many of the Puritan Anglicans to these shores, and so brought their concept of ministry to the ecclesiastical foundations of American Christianity. This means, then, that the first Americans identified the ministry almost exclusively with the proclamation of the word. In contrast to Rome and to other elements within Protestantism that persisted in appeals to ecclesiastical tradition, as well as in contrast to even more radical Protestants who emphasized an ongoing special revelation of visions or inner lights, here I'm thinking of the Quakers who arose in these years, these New England Puritans maintained that the scriptures alone were the only rule and norm for faith and life, life in this world as well as in the world to come. For them, there were no spiritual or moral issues that the Bible did not address and answer infallibly. On the one hand, they were remarkably literate, and the Bible was their favorite reading material. The Bible heavily annotated in accordance with the best Reformed theology, which is one of the reasons that the Geneva Bible, first produced in 1560, continued to be a Puritan favorite for years after the publication of the King James Bible in 1611, which was not printed for some time in an annotated self-study edition. On the other hand, these same Puritans look to their clergy for biblical expertise. Their clergy were university men who studied the word in the original tongues, practiced exegesis according to the strict rules of Reformed hermeneutics, and then explained and applied the Bible in sermons delivered every Sunday, as well as on numerous other special occasions, fast days, Thanksgiving days, election days, and the like. Puritan preaching dominated the public discourse of New England. Its form was a, quote, plain style that rejected all Latin allusions and references to the fathers, preferring instead a scriptural commentary that was directly applicable to their listeners' situation. Almost invariably, Puritan preachers would begin with a text, extract a doctrine, offer additional biblical proofs of that doctrine, and then apply that doctrine through what they called uses to the issues and problems that the congregation and its members were experiencing. Furthermore, on account of their intimate association with the Anglican state church tradition, such sermons often found contemporary application in the social and political affairs of the community. Now, in the years following the establishment of New England, American Christianity would experience many movements far removed from its original Puritans, with the result that one must be extremely cautious about attributing any contemporary characteristic of the American churches to these Puritan founders. However, with respect to our general understanding of the ministry, even after decades of higher critical assault upon the word, my guess would be that most Americans still assume that their pastor is an expert in the Bible, and that their greatest expectation is that he will be an effective preacher. Now, pastors today must be many other things as well, I'm sure. But biblical preaching is still what most Americans expect when they go to church. As far as church order is concerned, Puritanism may or may not have been a source of American egalitarianism, but it is certainly true that Americans are much more comfortable with boards and committees, with elections and choices, than they are with authoritarian hierarchies. I suspect that this has a lot more to do with political and social arrangements than with a Puritan theology of ministry, but even so, Puritanism proved to be on the winning cultural side of American history. Now, as Lutherans, I don't think we can learn a whole lot from the Puritans or the Anglicans regarding the ministry, especially since we have managed to exist with more than one form of church government through the years. However, I am convinced that studying Puritanism does help us to understand the American milieu, and perhaps that can help us to be more effective proponents of confessional Lutheranism. Our people are Americans as well as Lutherans, and that means that in some ways and at some times they may also exhibit a little bit of Puritanism. For good or for ill, it's important to know what you're dealing with. Thank you.
Professor McKenzie would be glad to entertain a few questions. Maybe that's why we're having such a problem with Reformed theology. We stand like Luther's cow at the gate he's never seen before.
Dr. Price. I think this was a very, very excellent and informative essay.
Thanks.
And delivered in a very simple, comprehensible way. I have one question. You mentioned, I think, the adjective called twice in your essay, but you never explained what the call was. I have just read through all the Reformed confessions, Calvinistic, Puritan, and so forth, and I find the same thing happening, that the call is referred to, but never really defined, and what places the minister in office may or may not be, in the thinking of these theologians, the call. Could you shed any light on my problem?
I can try. Basically, the Puritans I was talking about, as well as the Anglicans I was talking about, were extremely reluctant to conceive of the call as any kind of real inner call. What I mean by that is, though they wanted people who really were committed to the Christian faith, they did not want to embrace any kind of idea that you could put yourself into the ministry because you felt the Spirit. The debate actually between the defenders of the establishment and, let's say, the Presbyterians over the ministry did revolve about how the institutional church called an individual. But in both cases, it would be the institutional church through which God worked to place a man into the ministry. The Anglican system was a combination of, and I think this was probably true even in Germany at the same time, of lay patronage and official consecration or ordination, Episcopal consecration or ordination. To obtain a living, you needed a lay patron. He would nominate you for that position, and then the church, through the bishop, would affirm his choice by means of ordination. The Presbyterians also would have accepted lay patronage. They would, however, have wanted the decision-making to rest at a lower level, in particular at the congregational level and provincial level or presbytery level, working together. What makes my Puritans Presbyterians rather than Congregationalists is that the last word would have resided with the higher level, the National Synod, whereas we find in America a tendency more toward Congregationalism, where the last word resides with the congregation itself. But in both cases, call for them, as well as for the Anglicans, will actually boil down to a decision of the institutional church, God working through the visible church. There are, however, others on what's called the leftward side of Puritanism, emerges especially during the English Civil War and in the army, where you have these self-proclaimed pastors who've had the conversion, have had the experience, and so they now just get up on a soapbox and begin to preach. And that adds another dimension to the whole thing that we didn't get in here today, but my Puritans, the one I'm talking about, really didn't want to have much to do with that.
Thank you very much. That clarifies for me my coming up essay quite a bit. Thank you.
Good, good.
Please identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Pastor Bob Zick from Fredonia, Wisconsin. Appreciated your essay. I'm interested in, you mentioned the word and sacrament emphasis
right.
of these people in their ministry. Did they have any continuing contact or reference to the Lutheran confessions as they were being developed in the 1570s and 80s?
Yes. First of all, with respect to the Anglican Confession, the 39 Articles, there's a history of the 39 Articles that goes back in some measure to the Augsburg Confession. Dr. Preusser, or Dr. Scare, I think it is, who's talking about Article 5 later. Actually, Article 5 of the Augsburg Confession is almost quoted in the 39 Articles. But then, in terms of Dr. Preuss's point about the call, which is unclear in the Augustana, it's a little clearer in the 39 articles because they do at least allude to that system of lay patronage we were talking about before. With respect to the later Lutheranism, particularly the Formula of Concord, you will find, yes, references to it, but not favorable ones. As you know, from at least the time of the Formula of Concord, Lutherans were concerned to define themselves both over against the Catholics and the Reformed. Anglicans and Puritans at the same time are concerned to define themselves as one with the Continental Reformed.